Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, can I please speak with Rebecca Mead?
Speaking.
Rebecca, what a pleasure to have you on this call. I'm so happy you could be part of the Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Onassis LA and Dublab. I'm wondering, Rebecca, how have these past 14 or 15 months been for you of this delirious time in our life?
Is it 14? Is it 15? Is it 20? Is it 30? I mean, who knows? I've completely lost track of time, and rather than moving around in space, I've been reduced very small circuit. So it's been a very peculiar time in both time and space.
I feel that for so many people I've spoken to, and for us in our own life, we don't even have to speak to people. We realize that time feels so different. This last year has been so incredible. One doesn't really know what day of the week it is, what a weekend might mean. Of course, these are not terrible problems to have, but I think that our sense of time has changed fundamentally. And I feel also, Rebecca, that having read you for much of my adult life, particularly in the pages of The New Yorker, I feel in reading you recently that something has shifted, and I feel as if the pandemic has made you think differently, perhaps, at least during this time, of the kind of profiles you want to write. It's as if the pandemic compelled you to think differently. I'm wondering if this is true. It feels to me that you've focused your attention on different matters, and I'm particularly thinking of two pieces of yours, one on swimming and the other one on gardening. And I'd like to begin with the recent article you wrote maybe less than a year ago on the therapeutic power of gardening. Of all things, I wouldn't have suspected you to write this except when I started to read it. And you particularly focus on the work of a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist who is fascinating, named Sue Stewart Smith. Can you say something about this piece and about this book she wrote, which is called The Well-Gardened Mind?
Yes, I mean, I wrote this about a year ago, although it seems both like yesterday and a lifetime ago. And I wrote it because, you know, when lockdown began here in London, where I am, there was a lot of anxiety about whether people were going to be able to get hold of vegetables. And there was a lot of kind of panic gardening that started to happen. But there was also, you know, nobody was allowed to go anywhere. You know, we were confined to our homes, weren't we? And we were, in Britain, allowed to go out for one period of exercise a day. So we were really locked up at home. And in Britain, you know, the majority of people do have a garden, and most people do have some outdoor space. You know, and I have a very small garden in the house I live in London. And so these spaces became more and more important. Now, the British are people who love to garden, and there's a great tradition of British gardening. So this was not an extraordinary leap of behavior. It was just a sort of intensification of a national trait, maybe, that was already there. But as a British person by birth, and then spending 30 years in America, I've come back to Britain, and everything that I see here, I see with, you know, eyes that are partly familiar and partly very estranged. And so, you know, the interest in gardening was something that interested me. And the work of Sue Stewart Smith was, to me, a very fascinating kind of bringing together of different traditions in this country, this sort of tenderness with which British people care for their gardens, but there are also sort of certain traditions in psychoanalysis, and particularly the work of the British psychoanalyst and pediatrician Donald Winnicott, who was a very important person in Sue Stuart Smith's thinking, who talked about these very influential concepts of the relationships between mothers and children, and the ways in which mothers hold their children, but also provide space for their children to separate and individuate. And Sue writes very beautifully and compellingly about the ways in which gardening and being in a garden has some of that function for grown-ups too. So, you know, we all can think of being out in the garden as a, you know, a nice thing to do and a calming thing to do. But she talks about the kind of really restorative and psychologically healing ways that caring for a garden can help all of us, but especially can help people with trauma and damage from their own childhood. So it was a very compelling book that came along at exactly the right moment, because, you know, getting out in the garden was the only thing that anybody could do.
No, it was utterly compelling to me to read this connection between gardening and Winnicott. I mean, recently I had a conversation with Rebecca Solnit where she spoke about the relationship between gardening and George Orwell. I mean, these two moments recently, now speaking with you and speaking with Rebecca Solnit just before speaking with you, have been incredibly compelling and making me think about gardening in a new fashion. And I must say, it seems very convincing. And I want to read a paragraph for the pleasure for you to hear your own prose, but also for my listeners to hear how beautifully this essay of yours is crafted. You say at the more or less at the start of the article, you say another reported that trees offered him mute, complete acceptance. There is a tree, and I am sitting here, no expectations, no questions, no nothing. Gardening can also help heal a mind wounded by more ordinary forms of grief, such as bereavement. Contemplating the restorative effect of working the soil in her own yard, Stuart Smith writes that, in the safe curtilage of the garden, I am in the kind of company that allows me to be alone and enter my own world. When I read those words this spring, while sitting by my withered arugula on the terrace of the house where I had largely been confined, I reflected that my urge to sow seeds was about more than keeping my fridge stocked. Gardening provided a way of being alongside my mother, whom I could not visit as she pottered alone in the space of my childhood. Rebecca, reading that was truly powerful, because you brought together Winnicott, Sue, and of course your mother. And I always think of that passage which you quote in one way, and I've always quoted in another way, in which Winnicott says in an extraordinary essay called The Contribution of Mothers to Society, he says that the goal is for the child to be alone in the presence of the mother, which for me has always been the best definition of reading. But it happens to be also one of the most beautiful definitions of gardening.
What a wonderful bringing together of reading and gardening. Yes, yes, it's true. I mean, you know, my mother still lives in the house where I grew up on the south coast of England. She's just turned 90. And she and my father have lived, well, my father's now dead, but she and my father lived in that house for more than 50 years. Well, she's now lived in it for more than 50 years. And the garden is something that she and my father built together and grew together. My father's ashes are scattered in the garden. So when I go there, I see him kind of omnipresent in that garden and dispersed. You know, in moving to England, as I did now almost 3 years ago, one of the things that I thought about was that I'll finally be closer to my mother. And the irony of being separated from her, not by an ocean, but by a pandemic, was not lost on either of us during those, especially during those first few months, and communicating with her about what I should do with the very small garden that I have here in London, and how I should, you know, what I should do with the lavender, you know, what should I do with it? How should I prune the rose? I mean, these are not things that I've ever thought about. I mean, I had it when I lived in Brooklyn for a decade and a half, and there was a garden, there was a backyard, but it was much more a thing that I looked at and also occasionally paid somebody else to come and take care of, that it was something that I dwelt in or cultivated myself or cared for or nurtured. And so there's been something rather, you know, wonderful about having that opportunity to do it now, and also being able to have this dialogue with my mother. And so we, you know, I sent her photographs. I sent her a photograph this morning of what?
Of geraniums,
some geraniums I'd planted, some of them in plastic, some of them in terracotta. The ones in plastic have grown better than the ones in terracotta. Why? I don't know. Perhaps my mother will know.
And?
She doesn't know either, but the idea of being able to continue this conversation of now, you know, 54 years that I've been on this earth, having a conversation with my mother, and now we're having it through gardening is, you know, it's lovely, and I treasure it.
And I remember so clearly when we spoke so many years ago at the New York Public Library about Middlemarch and your great book about Middlemarch. In a sense, that was also a way of, through Middlemarch, talking to your mother and father.
It was, yes. I mean, perhaps that's what we all end up doing, isn't it? After, you know, striking off in for foreign parts, saying, you know, get me the hell out of here. I don't want to have anything to do with this. And then we return, and if we're lucky, we have the opportunity to have a different kind of conversation than one that's, you know, slamming the door and saying, I'm off.
Right, and it's a mediated conversation. And what is so interesting in this piece, I really want to give the listeners a sense of it and urge them to read it the minute they've heard this conversation between you and me, is you say, quoting again Sue Stewart Smith, you say, when we sow, we plant a narrative of future possibility. That made me think so much of wonderful lines of a poet I adore, W.S. Merwin, who said that on the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. Or Martin Luther, who said, even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree. How does that resonate with you?
Well, there's a lot of talk, isn't there, about the end of the world, and there's a lot of talk about you know, the end of humanity. And when we think about the end of the world as humans, we tend to think of it in terms of the end of humanity. And then there are folk who will remind us that the world will go on, even without us in it. There will be a world of some sort, and perhaps that world that goes on will have trees in it. I'm not zen enough, or whatever the right term would be, to be able to face that with much equanimity, that prospect of a world without us but with trees. But it will be nice for the trees.
Yes, they will be witnesses, as it were. And it brings to mind again a great poem of Merwin, which is called Witness, where he says, I want to tell what the forest were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. And what interests me here is that, Rebecca, you of all people are learning a new language.
Yeah, it's true. I am much more, since being back in Britain, and, you know, it's peculiar, that this kind of coincidence of time, right? I mean, I moved back to London, or moved to London, almost 3 years ago. And I was talking about this with my husband this morning. You know, the first year is spent in just the chaos of moving. So you don't even, your feet have barely hit the ground. And then the second year, we were sort of establishing ourselves and making some friends and discovering the world this different location. And now the third year has been spent in the pandemic. And so I'm learning a new language, but it's also an old language. It's a return, you know, because I'm returning to the place from which I originated and relearning things that I had forgotten. I mean, there's so much about being back in this country that in a kind of sensory way that that it's very peculiar to become reacquainted with, and things like, you know, climate and light and the passage of the seasons. I'm having to relearn all of that anew. You know, the we've had a terrible spring in terms of weather in Britain. I know the British talk about weather all the time. There's a reason why. It's because it's very compelling and changeable, and it can be awful. And when it's good, we feel blessed and uplifted. And we've had a terrible, terrible, you know, loads of rain, very cold. And, you know, so every time the sun shines, as it is right now, there's this urgency, you know, this urgent feeling to get outside and be in it and appreciate it, because it is so fleeting. And I suppose we could make a very obvious comparison to, you know, to take that as a very obvious metaphor for the experience of going through life itself. But yeah, it's being back here has brought me back to thinking about those things. You know, I also live a step away from Hampstead Heath. I'm incredibly lucky to be very close to a spectacular open wild space. And so, especially during the pandemic, in the beginning, when we were allowed to go out, as I say, once a day, I would go out there and walk through the woods and walk over the meadows. And it feels like being in the English countryside, especially with the cessation of planes and not very much in the way of distant traffic noise. You know, it's like being back in the heart of something.
Again, in that piece, I mean, there's so much to unpack. I mean, really so much to unpack. I loved the way in which, again, Winnicott came in terms of, that the garden expresses a mutuality of a long marriage in which enthusiasm have been exchanged. And the notion of the garden being a place where a couple that has been together for a long time can be both together and, in a sense, separate.
Yeah, well, Sue Stuart Smith's husband, Tom Stuart Smith, is a very famous and accomplished landscape designer and gardener, and has built some beautiful gardens, made some beautiful gardens all over the country. And so their home and their garden, which I did actually get to, having first only talked to them on Zoom, my first pandemic outing with my husband was to go and visit their garden in person. And, you know, so it's become this place in which the two of them have explored their interests in both how plants grow and in how we relate to those plants and what landscape means for us emotionally. You know, it's lovely when you see a marriage, their marriage has lasted a lot longer than my relatively new marriage by comparison, is a mere 16 years. No, 17. Sorry, I've lost track. I've got no idea. Well, see, I told you I don't know what year it is. I think it's 17. You know, they've been married much, much, much longer, and you see this kind of beautiful growth of interest and space together. Yeah, much as I saw with my parents and the garden that they created together.
And another extraordinary passage in this beautiful essay is you invoke, because Sue does, the relationship that Freud had with his garden, which was not much of a relationship because he was sick and dying and had left Vienna, I believe, in 1938. And you have this fabulous passage, which, please allow me to read it. You say, this is the evidence not just of a garden's power to distract and inspire, as it was for Freud, but of its power to console through its cyclical replenishment. And then this paragraph, which I adore, particularly because of one word being italicized. The spring and summer of 2020 have been shadowed by deaths, not just by the loss of hundreds of thousands of people to COVID-19, but by the loss of our ordinary way of life. gardening has been a solace to so many, Sue Stewart Smith suggested to me, because it invokes a prospect of, and then this word is italicized, of some kind of future, however uncertain and unpredictable it may be. When the future seems either very bleak or people are too depressed to imagine one, gardening gives you a toehold in the future, she said. It can help reconcile us to the inevitability of our demise. At the barn garden, Tom Stewart Smith told me that every spring, when the bulbs of fawn lilies and summer snowflakes are flowering, and the meadow is full of narcissus, he goes around the garden with a notebook to make plans about where to add things in the autumn. I think a lot about next year, but I also think absolutely about what it's going to be like when I am dead, he said. The future promised by a garden may not always be ours to enjoy, but a future there will be, with or without us in it. Tremendous, Rebecca.
Thank you.
I mean, really tremendous. It made me think of another activity that Rebecca Mead has been up to, which is swimming. And again, you wrote this incredibly shorter but beautiful profile in a way, but not really, of Roger Deakin. And you read a book of his called Waterlog, which I'm not familiar with again. So I have new things to discover, which is a pleasure of talking with people I enjoy talking to. And it's you speak about swimming through Roger Deakin as a subversive act, a way of reclaiming nature. And I'd like you to unpack that a little bit, if you could.
Sure. Roger Deakin's book, Waterlog, is an account of his experience of sort of swimming through the British Isles in lakes and rivers and seas and lochs. And it's a very beautiful book, and is a very, here, quite a well-known and popular book. There's a lot of interest in swimming, and by which I mean, you know, swimming out in lakes or rivers, and, you know, not so much, you know, inside a pool, in a chlorinated pool. You know, the term that's used here is wild swimming, and that, yeah, you know, yes. one sort of cringes slightly at the adding of wild to something that is, it's not that wild, you know, it's just swimming. But I wanted to write about it because it seemed like a phenomenon when I arrived back here in London. And I live very close. I'm very, very lucky to live close to these ponds where people swim on Hampstead Heath, which are very cold and very, very beautiful. And they are swum in year round in all kinds of weather and in all kinds of temperatures. And I started to swim in them when I moved to this area, you know, in the spring through to the summer, and thinking, you know, that this would be a lovely thing to do, but I didn't know how long I would last. But I kept going and ended up swimming through the winter with the hardy elderly ladies who do the same thing. And it's become really a kind of, I do it just about every day. In fact, I'm dying to go now. And
quick.
Soon, yeah, once we get off the phone, yeah, That's where I'll be going. So, you know, the waters in this country are cold. They never get warm. The lakes are cold. The sea is cold. If you're going to swim in Britain, you have to reconcile yourself to this experience of cold. And swimming is not then any longer a thing that you do to cool off when you're in a hot place and refresh yourself. It is a kind of discipline and a practice. And it's like going for a walk, but you're doing it in any weather, and it's in water. And so there's this kind of shift mentally in thinking about what swimming is. And I have found it to be, as a way of kind of reacclimatizing to being in this country, it's been quite a useful metaphor for me, because, you know, I can't make it warmer. I can't make the water be nicer and be more tolerable in that way. I have to learn to live with what there is. And become acclimatized to it and even learn to appreciate it and even perhaps learn to enjoy it. So that's been a thing for me here. Gardening and swimming, you're going to ask, I'm not yet into jigsaw puzzles, but that's like the next thing on the list, isn't it?
Perhaps, but quite seriously, Rebecca, I feel that both gardening and swimming, if we think of them as kind of acts of resistance in some way, come to some extent in the depths with which particularly gardening was investigated for you in that piece, out of this very, very troubled moment. And somehow I'm not sure that Rebecca Mead would have written these pieces hadn't it been for this moment in time. I'm not sure I'm right. I may be wrong, but it felt to me that way. And when I think, does this make sense, Rebecca?
It does. Although I did write about swimming before the pandemic hit, and then it seemed fortuitous kind of thing to have been thinking about in advance of this moment. But certainly with the gardening, having the focus and also the restriction of life and not being able to go anywhere else other than my own house and my own garden gave me the space and the stimulus to think about those things. I mean, normally my life as a reporter involves a lot of, getting on planes, getting on trains, talking to people, going to see things, going to watch people do things in different places. And none of that was possible. And so there was a necessity to find new ways of reporting and writing and having, finding something to say and finding a space to write something that was going to bring me the solace and the comfort that writing does. So the sense of making something on the page or on the screen, I've been very, very fortunate that work has continued for me, and that work is something has been something that I've been able to do, and that it's not been curtailed by this pandemic, and it gives me a lot of hope and satisfaction. But finding these kind of what might, what are in some ways quieter themes,
right? Yes.
Has been, it's been a comfort to be able to do those things.
And when I read your piece on swimming, I was reminded of perhaps my favorite essay by Oliver Sacks, which was published actually in your magazine, you may or may not know it, in May of 1997, called Water Babies, where Oliver Sacks talks about this pleasure in immersion. Why? Because when he was a baby, his father, before he knew how to swim, immersed him in the water. So wherever Oliver Sacks went, wherever he went on any trip, he looked for water to swim in. And he says, I never knew anything powerfully so healthily euphoriant, and I was addicted to it, am still addicted to when I cannot swim. Duns Scotus in the 13th century spoke of condelacteri sibi, the will finding delight in its own exercise. There's an essential lightness about swimming, as about all such flowing and, so to speak, musical activities. My father swam daily, slowing down only slightly with time, until the grand old age of 94. I hope I can follow him and swim till I die. And just remembering this piece as I was reading yours, I was thinking, on the one hand, gardening brings you close to your mother, and here is an article by Oliver Sacks which brings him, through an activity such as swimming, close to his father.
It's very beautiful. But the word that leaps out at me, and that I would say my experience is different to his, is the lightness of swimming. Because I don't know what kind of waters Oliver Sacks was swimming in, but so much of the time swimming here in this country, it's not a light experience. It's a very intense and, often very austere experience to be in the cold, immersed, you know, up to the neck, surrounded by ducks and, you know, other wildfowl. And it's not, of course, there's a buoyancy in swimming, but there's also a gravity, you know, that at any moment you could go under. And that's that living in that, on that meniscus, I suppose is the word, where you're just above, but you could be below, is a very intense and not, I would say, a light experience, but a heavy one.
Rebecca, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you, as it always is. And I am very much looking forward also to your forthcoming book, Homeland, about your travels back to what nurtured you when you started out, namely going back to England after having been for a very long time in America. It will be such a pleasure to read it next year.
Thank you.
In the meantime, take very good care of yourself. And now, please just go out and swim.
I shall. It's lovely to talk to you, Paul. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.